The opinions expressed are those of the program hosts and guests and are not those of WPSL's staff, management, or sponsors. WPSL does not endorse products that may be mentioned. Any reproduction or retransmission of this broadcast is strictly prohibited without written consent of WPSL. It's time now for the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour, and here's your host, attorney Michael Raybuck.
Good morning and happy Friday to you. This is attorney Michael Raybuck, and you're listening to the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour on AM 1590 WPSL. I am here with Veronica. Good morning, Veronica.
Good morning.
I'm chief counsel for my firm, Michael Todd Raybuck, PA, and we're located at 1025 Southwest Martin Downs Boulevard in Palm City, where we focus on two areas of practice: family law, including issues related to simple and complex divorce, spousal support, paternity, contempt, enforcement of existing orders, establishment and modification of orders, division of assets and liabilities, dependency, and children's issues. We also practice in personal injury litigation, representing clients who've been injured in auto accidents and negligence cases. In addition to being licensed by the Florida Bar, I'm certified by the Supreme Court of Florida as a family law mediator. I'm also admitted to practice before the United States Federal Courts of the Northern, Middle, and Southern Districts of Florida, as well as the United States Tax Court. Radio Hour focuses our discussion on family law issues. The phone lines are open at 340-1590, and we'll try to answer your questions regarding a divorce or perhaps a time-sharing situation that you may have. But whether you choose to contact me today or just listen to the information that we share with you, this is an opportunity for free consultation. Family law attorneys, like most attorneys, we're very busy preparing our cases for court. We're preparing for trial and preparing for litigation. We've got to make time to meet with and consult with existing and potential clients. This is how our business works. And there's really not nearly enough time to satisfy the demand that's out there for answering all the questions associated with family law. So radio is a great forum to sort of speak in a collective way for purposes of disseminating information and letting people know what's out there in the area of family law. Some attorneys are also business owners, and our time is further constrained by the commitment for keeping our business properly managed. So I really look forward to this as an opportunity to speak with you, the listeners. You have a question about a family law matter or a personal injury case, you may call me at the office. My telephone number is 772-600-8166. I'll be glad to schedule a free consultation or speak to you personally on the phone regarding your case. You may also email me at michael@raybucklawfirm.com, and Raybuck is spelled R-E-B-U-C-K. Visit our website at www.thefamilylawattorney.net. You can email us right on the website. There are also links to Facebook and YouTube as well. My goal is to address issues that are pervasive to the profession in the area of family law. Last several weeks, I've been doing a lot of observation at the time that I've been spending in court, specifically to sort of sort out and think of ideas for what to talk about on the radio hour. It's really my aim to bring in our time together information that's current and useful for our listeners. And I think it's about time after 12 weeks that I address the issue of alimony in some detail. So we're going to talk a little bit about alimony today and some issues, derivative issues regarding financial affidavits, and a little bit about what's called equitable distribution in Florida. We'll talk about that. And if we have time left over, I had a question about adoption that I would like to go over with you perhaps in the final minutes of the hour. So let's take a look at alimony issues. Alimony can be one of the most, and actually it is one of the most contentious issues in a Florida divorce, assuming that alimony is pled in an initial pleading. And in most divorce cases, I would say that that's generally true. So that issue has to be contended with at some point in most divorces, but not all of them. Sometimes the issue is waived by one or both parties at the outset of a litigation, and they focus on other things, child care issues, time sharing, division of assets and liabilities, but not related to alimony. But alimony is actually a very important focus for family law and for family law attorneys. It's also known as spousal support, and the design of alimony is to provide the lower income spouse with money for living expenses over and above money that's going to be provided by child support. Again, child support if it's a child support case. There obviously are cases where alimony is the only issue and that child support is not relevant, but it really just depends on the particular case that we're talking about. Spousal support differs from child support in that child support is a simple mathematical calculation using guidelines published by the state. I know that we've gone over this. And by contrast, spousal support is discretionary and requires balancing of multiple factors. Though there's certainly no rule saying so, it's generally seen as rare that spousal support is awarded in marriages that lasted only a few years. So there's sort of a sliding scale that's not necessarily codified or written down anywhere, but that that the court will use with respect to the amount of time being a relevant factor for purposes of whether alimony will even be awarded. In a marriage that lasts only a few years, it would be atypical, it would be non-typical for alimony to be awarded. But obviously every case is different, so that's not a hard and fast rule. It's also rare to see alimony awarded in cases where the incomes of the parties are close to being equal. Alimony is typically reserved for situations where one spouse has been economically dependent on the other for most of a lengthy marriage. I personally have been in situations at mediation or other parts in the litigation continuum where myself or the other side has simply made the argument that alimony is not relevant in this particular case, either because the parties have incomes that are not disparate or that are similar, or depending on the factors in a particular situation, say a situation where parties are sharing time working a business, there might be a strong argument that the lesser income spouse, so to speak, really doesn't qualify for alimony because, in fact, the business is made in such a way that the parties are really both benefiting equally. And there are circumstances that would allow alimony to sort of be looked upon as not relevant if we go into a court setting. So, again, alimony is typically going to be reserved for situations where there is a disparate need. And it basically comes down to, similar to child support, one side is looking to limit the amount of alimony or get out of it altogether. The other side is interested in what's the number going to be. Ultimately, it really is that simple. It's just a matter of looking at all of the factors and determining, what's the best course of action and what can the parties ultimately live with respect to getting it negotiated and resolved, if at all. Again, though, there are no hard and fast rules with respect to this, and exceptions do exist, and exceptions to exceptions do exist. And ultimately, it's going to be a judge weighing all of the factors and using judicial discretion in the event a alimony issue gets to a trial. I will indicate, though, that there is a factor that one party's bad behavior may be responsible for the dissolution of the marriage, and that may affect an alimony award. And we'll talk about that a little more expansively later. There is a possibility of something that is called rehabilitative alimony, which typically is involved with shorter marriages. Not always. Sometimes long-term marriages can end up in just being rehabilitative alimony, depending on the circumstances. But there are numerous types of alimony. Permanent periodic alimony is the one that most people who are familiar with this issue either hear about or have at the forefront of their mind. Permanent periodic alimony being the one that generally lasts forever, and obviously there's been a lot of talk both in the papers and in the courts and anywhere where legal issues are important that permanent periodic alimony is a target for changes, legislative changes, statutory changes with respect to it, because it does exist in Florida. Permanent periodic alimony, or permanent alimony for want of a better word, is in fact very much used in our state, and judges will do permanent alimony awards, which, depending on the nature, could be modifiable or non-modifiable. Rehabilitative support, though, we were talking about that. It's a means that some courts will use when one spouse's needs, a spouse will need a transitional period where they'll need income of some sort. They'll need some support to get back into the job market, so to speak. Someone who might be educated but hasn't worked in the field of their profession for a long period of time, but who's interested and able to do that type of work, may get a rehabilitative alimony award given the circumstances of a particular case for a short period of time to let them go back to school, perhaps get a little bit more training, any number of issues that might lead to them getting a better employment type situation or job/business situation.
But you can make that going back to school business last quite a while, can't you?
Absolutely. And that's something that the parties are going to have to look at more than the courts, because the parties, if one party is going to end up having to pay an alimony award for the other side to go back to school, they're going to want to know some things like how long is it going to take, what is a reasonable period of time, because that's going to ultimately factor into what the alimony award is and also long-term what the total award will be over a period of time. So just hypothetically, to expand upon that, if you're paying $500 a month for someone to go back to school, and this is just a number, I'm not
sure
labeling it, you'll want to know how long is that $6,000 a year going to be something that I have to pay for. But just so that there's full understanding of what we're talking about.
Oh, and then once I'm educated, I have to look for a job.
Oh, absolutely. You're going to have to look for a job.
And that's hard these days.
You get into lots of issues.
So this could come like semi-permanent, this alimony, actually.
It could actually become semi-permanent.
Is child support and alimony handled like two different ways? Is it two different checks that this person has to send out? Or
generally, I mean, it's two different concepts within the law. I mean, child support will be whatever that is. That's determined by statutory guidelines based upon the amount of time sharing in Florida, the amount of time sharing and the income of the parties. They've come up with a number, and mm-hmm. the number is what it is. And there's some slight variation that the courts will typically accept, but that's its own number. And then alimony is something separate. But can one check be written for both each month? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, last week you covered the non-payment and the suspension of the driver's license if child support's not paid. Is there anything in place for non-payment of alimony?
Enforcement of alimony?
Mm-hmm.
The most favored one and the one that's most common is contempt. You simply take the go back to court for contempt and enforcement of the existing order. That's really the main one.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas child support has has an administrative agency that's mm-hmm. looking out for the best interest of the child,
right,
where they can do X, Y, and Z, license suspension, all that stuff. More likely in alimony situations, almost virtually all alimony situations, you're going to see contempt.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to be drawn back into court and say, look, you have an existing order.
Well, you're a grown-up. You can fight for yourself.
That's right.
And the kids, the court helps them.
Right. That's an interesting point, too, because the counterpoint to being dragged into court for contempt is always going to be ability to pay. So the paying spouse in an alimony award is going to have – the burden is going to switch to them after the case is made that they need to pay this,
mm-hmm.
that they can't because they don't have the ability to pay. And it gets very interesting at that point because then a judge is going to apply what they're learning at these contempt hearings to decide – okay, how do I get him to compel, to pay? How does he have the ability to pay? And if he doesn't have the ability to pay, what do I do in those situations? We could get in – actually, I'm thinking about this as we're talking. Alimony should probably be its own hour because we can probably expound upon these things. And I may even do that next week. But just to address the point that you're saying, there's actually federal rules or state rules that apply to federal rules that allow Social Security or certain – Social Security type benefits can be attached to satisfy a alimony award. A certain percentage of those benefits in lieu of any other ability to pay could then be attached to continue alimony payments. Alimonies are considered very important by the courts, and those payments are not dischargeable in bankruptcy, so they protect them. And there are other, beyond contempt, one way to enforce is to simply take someone's Social Security, a portion of their Social Security check.
So when it comes time for them to collect, there's just less money there for, what if you're not of that age?
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I was probably talking, but I suppose disability, I don't remember if just offhand if disability would be exempt from that. But if it's not a situation, if it's of age, then I suppose they'll look at things like bank accounts. They'll look at real property. They'll look at assets that the paying spouse has to see if there is some way to enforce upon them, put liens on them, perhaps mm-hmm. sell assets for purposes of paying the alimony award. And this, of course, obviates the issue of modification. Obviously, the paying party, either party really, can file for modification, and that may have to happen. We'll talk a little bit about what that means. Modification is not easy for an alimony award. Typically, there are some hurdles that have to be done to get that. You've got to show a change in circumstances, substantial change in circumstances to change any alimony award. And if you're not successful in establishing that there are substantial changes, then the alimony award's not going to change. And you're just going to keep getting hauled back into court mm-hmm. as long as you don't pay that award.
Right.
Very similar to what happens with child support. Mm-hmm. It's just it's different in that alimony tends to be...
Well, there's that added little problem of not having your driver's license, too, if you don't pay the child support.
Yeah. Alimony cases, enforcement of alimony cases, tend to be cases where there either was an ability to pay the alimony at the outset of the case and that's been lost,
mm-hmm.
or for whatever reason the paying ex-spouse no longer wants to pay. And that's just a generic way of saying maybe they can't pay, maybe they don't want to pay, but the information that the court receives shows there's still an ability to pay and that's failing to happen, which means there's going to be enforcement of some form. And contempt, including derivative jail time where the court tries to coerce you to come up with a lump sum, it'll happen. And
it's got to keep you guys busy in court because if you're fairly young and you divorce and you marry again, now you have two families to support, and that's got to be difficult to support two families. Because if you're writing a check for alimony and you're writing a check for child support and now you found a new honey, and how do you pay those bills? So I'm sure that non-payment happens regularly.
Yes, it's one of the overlooked factors in any divorce situation is that you're no longer now going to be having half of the bills that you previously had. There are now going to be two full-grown incomes. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's going to be
unless
double.
Unless you can move back into your mom's basement or something.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So what's going to happen is you go out with good intentions. Oh, I can pay this alimony award, and we've got everything settled. And the court says, okay, fine, we're going to go with the agreement. You guys, good luck to you. And you find out, well, I have double the expenses that I had before. Mm-hmm. I've got two mortgages that I need to pay now, and I want to keep this house that I can could afford before I had this mm-hmm. alimony award. But now mm-hmm. I can't pay this alimony award. Well, guess what? Nobody made you buy that house or that boat or whatever.
Or say I do in the first place.
That's right. Well, but you do have a judgment now against you that says you pay that alimony and that is your priority. Mm-hmm. All this other stuff that you want to do and you have fun doing, that's not.
Maybe no flat screen TVs in your future.
That's right.
Yeah.
So as we mentioned earlier, good question, Veronica. Thank you. As we mentioned earlier, there's no formula for determining the amount of spousal support. That's going to come down in large part, in most cases, to what the parties are able to agree to or that they do agree to. I guess suppose the ability is always going to be in question, given the fact that there are so many contempt actions for alimony out there. But getting back to the greater point, the decision is going to come down to the trial court judge in the event the parties cannot agree. Alimony is going to be granted only on a showing of need by one party together with a corresponding ability to pay by the other. So at the outset, and by outset I mean at the trial where this is going to be decided, one side's got to be able to show that there is an ability to pay the alimony. And then they're also that same side is typically going to have to show there's also a need for that to be paid. Some of the factors that go into that consideration include the following. Standard of living that the spouse has enjoyed during the marriage. Obviously, somebody who is on a fairly low hourly wage, even if he or she is the sole breadwinner in a case, those cases are typically not going to lend themselves to permanent periodic alimony. I mean, someone who works for $12 or $15 an hour is not going to be on the hook for the rest of his or her life for a former spouse, unless there's just some, to me, a relatively unlikely scenario that's going to make that necessary. However, alimony could still be awarded in low-dollar cases on a temporary or a rehabilitative, maybe even a lump sum type basis. They're going to look at how long the marriage has lasted. Like we said at the outset of the hour, marriages that are less than, say, 5 or 7 years, less likely that alimony is going to be awarded. But, say 12 or 15 years, certainly 20 years, those types of marriages lend themselves to the permanent alimony award. And many cases where marriages last in excess of, say, 15, 18 years, permanent alimony is going to be on the table at the outset of those litigations. Physical and emotional conditions of each spouse's resources at the time of the divorce, including non-marital assets, if any. The time that it would take a spouse needing the support to get his or her education or training necessary to support him or herself. Like Veronica said earlier, I mean, what's the number of years that you're going to have to be in training? Is it 12 years? Mm-hmm. I'll take 12 years of training.
Yeah, I'm going to school part-time.
That's right. It's going to be a part-time situation because we've got kids in the house. It takes a lot of my time and demands. The contribution of each spouse made during the marriage, and that would include things like homemaking, childcare, contributions to the other spouse's education, career, who put their career on hold or their working years on hold so that the other person could grow and thrive, and all sources of income that either spouse has access to. And I suppose that would include things like inheritances and income from other sources. The court's going to have the option to consider all of these and other factors as it deems necessary to be fair to both parties. And then unless there's a specific agreement stating otherwise, alimony is generally modifiable. But like we said earlier, it's not easy. It's not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So if a bankruptcy is filed somewhere down the line by a paying spouse, although that's going to be listed as part of the bankruptcy estate when they get to a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 11 or 13, 7 or 13, I guess, that's not going to be ultimately dischargeable. That alimony award is going to survive the bankruptcy, even though things like credit cards and maybe medical bills or other bills, contract bills, will ultimately be liquidated or discharged. Alimony will not be. Changing alimony requires a showing of a substantial change in circumstances, and typically this involves cases where the person paying the support has seen their income decline substantially for reasons that are not their fault, certainly getting older, necessary or mandatory retirement, things like that would be factors, and in such instances, the court can decide to reduce or totally eliminate the support award. The spousal support, the alimony. And then alimony, of course, stops completely if either party dies or when the spouse receiving alimony remarries or enters into a supportive relationship. And I guess just a real quick point with respect to that, the court will be interested in knowing the nature of a recipient's ex-spouse's supportive relationships. If a person is living with someone, perhaps that person is taking care of the majority, if not all, of the needs of the recipient ex-spouse. Alimony could be ended or could be terminated at that point, and that is not infrequent. That is one of the factors at a modification that the court will be looking at. In fact, in some cases, it is the sole factor that is relevant to whether alimony should stop. So, and of course, remarriage ends the award as well. I know we're coming up against a break here in a few minutes, but I just want to go over some interesting data regarding senior divorces, because the divorce rate of older folks, people in their 50s and 60s now, are showing some interesting trends. The number of senior divorces in this country has been growing, and with the baby boomers aging, the amount's likely to rise at an accelerated rate, not necessarily because of the values or culture of the baby boomer generation so much as just the raw numbers that are there, coupled with just factors of how our society has changed. This figure, by the way, is also true for people over the age of 65, which is outside the baby boomer generation. And, you know, it's not a phenomenon that's just exclusive to the fact that we have more people in that 55 to 65 range now than we did before. Because there are more people now than any time previous, however, the trend toward divorce is going to continue to accelerate. And those that have been through one marriage and are now remarried, just by statistics, they're about 2.5 times more likely to be divorced again than those who are still on their first marriage. So we've got a number of things sort of leading to this perfect storm in terms of the percentages of divorces that are happening among the older generation. And the reasons for the trend are really hard to nail down more specifically than that, but they do include things like the ages that people are living to, a greater acceptance of divorce in our culture, as we talked about, a rise in earning power and independence among females, and an increased emphasis on just living a happy life and individualism. Regardless of the cause, the trend has important financial implications for those that are going through a late-in-life divorce. The first thing to understand is that single life can be very expensive. Veronica and I talked about the doubling of expenses after a divorce. Well, that's absolutely true. It's not a simple matter of splitting all the bills in half. There's going to be a magnification to dividing the bills once there are separate households, and separate households are going to be much more expensive to run than the one-half equity that a marital household is going to have. And then beyond living expenses are the ordinary legal expenses associated with divorce, and we'll get into that on the other side of the hour. This is Attorney Michael Raybuck, and you're listening to the Raybuck Law Firm Radio Hour on 1590 WPSL.
This is WPSL Port St. Lucie, the talk of the Treasure Coast.
FNN News, I'm Deborah Roberts. State officials deny there's a problem with the warehousing of disabled kids in nursing homes and then announce a plan to fix it. FNN's Tallahassee Bureau Chief Rick Flagg reports.
The Justice Department has come down hard on Florida, accusing the state of warehousing disabled kids in geriatric nursing homes. So Surgeon General John Armstrong says they're setting up a new review process called the Children's Multidisciplinary Assessment Team.
The CMAT works to find the most medically appropriate health care setting within the community that will meet each child's needs. An emphasis is placed on the least restrictive setting possible.
Despite the creation of this new program, state officials still insist it's not a real problem and say they're waiting on the feds to get specific and start naming names. Rick Flagg, Tallahassee.
The Florida Highway Patrol is out with its ticket tally during its Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over campaign between Christmas and New Year's. FHP Sergeant Steve Gaskin says these holiday enforcement campaigns are paying dividends.
These kind of campaigns where troopers are out in force in conjunction with local law enforcement as well are very effective in removing impaired drivers off the roadways of Florida to make travel safer for friends and families to go enjoy the holiday period.
The FHP reports that 548 impaired drivers were arrested during this most recent effort, which is about average. Deaths and injuries continue to decline, and that's what it's all about. Hundreds of people have signed up for the first-of-its-kind python hunt in Florida. Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Committee leaders hope that an invasion of exotic snakes can be solved through an invasion of snake hunters. The FWC is paying people from across the country to go into the Everglades and kill Burmese pythons. More than 570 snake hunters will be in the Everglades this weekend. For the next month, anyone who pays $25 and watches a 30-minute safety video on the internet can be a licensed snake hunter. With news on the Florida News Network, I'm Deborah Roberts.
Leaving tobacco behind isn't an easy task. In all honesty, it's a very hard thing to do. The good news is, if you want to quit, Tobacco Free Florida offers free help, support, and the tools you'll need to succeed. When you log on to tobaccofreeflorida.com, you can connect to WebCoach, a free online program that's confidential and customized. WebCoach helps you create a quit plan that's right for you. You may also qualify for free nicotine replacement therapy. If you've tried to quit tobacco before, or if you've been avoiding trying to quit, now is the right time for you to succeed. You're just a click away from starting your quit plan. There's a quitter in you, and with the help of Tobacco Free Florida's three ways to quit, you'll double your chances of success. If you or someone you know needs help quitting tobacco, you can call 1-877-YOU-CAN-NOW or connect to WebCoach at tobaccofreeflorida.com. Quitting isn't easy, but Tobacco Free Florida can help.
Florida-based AAA has issued its wish list for the upcoming lawmaking season in the Sunshine State and across the country. Spokeswoman Karen Morgan says one of their top priorities is booster seats. Florida has some of the weakest laws in the nation when it comes to who should be in a booster seat.
What we're trying to do is pass legislation that requires children up to the height of 4'9", which is usually around age 8, to be in a booster seat. What that booster seat will do is essentially boost them up so that the safety belt fits over their lap correctly.
Also on the list for lawmakers is legislation targeting teen driver safety and legislation to deal with distracted driving. Morgan adds that some bills have already been filed to curtail distracted driving. Florida's two-month legislative session begins in March. For more news you care about, go to myflanews.com. I'm Deborah Roberts, FNN News.
Okay, be successful in my life.
You're listening to the Ray Buck Law Firm Radio Hour on WPSL 1590. Now back to your host, attorney Michael Ray Buck.
Welcome back to the Ray Buck Law Firm Radio Hour on AM 1590 WPSL. I am Michael Ray Buck. For questions about a family law or personal injury matter, call me for a free consultation at 772-600-8166. Email me at michael@raybucklawfirm.com. Visit our website, www.thefamilylawattorney.net. You can email me there as well. I've got links to Facebook and YouTube on there. We were discussing at the end of the last half hour issues regarding alimony, and I was talking a little bit about how alimony is affected in the older generation community. And we were looking at causes and reasons for why the divorce rate among people over age, say, 55 or 65 has been accelerating. And beyond living expenses, we were talking about the types of issues which would be inherent in alimony awards. Beyond the living expenses are the ordinary legal expenses that are associated just with divorce, with any divorce. New legal documents in these particular cases are going to need to be drafted, and often more information than if you had divorced at a younger age will be necessary. Just think inherently that divorces that happen among the older generation, there's going to be more stuff. There's going to be more money, more than likely. There's going to be more assets and possibly liabilities. And the parties are just simply going to have a more complex divorce. So it's obviously going to be...
I would think it would be more, very much more complex, because you have to remember the baby boomers now who are older, becoming seniors, they were also the yuppies who made more. That time frame, that's just that period in time, those people made a lot of money.
You're right. I probably am giving short shrift to the extreme
difference.
A lot
of people don't realize that the hippies were also the yuppies.
The people who are in that generation realize it.
Yeah, they do.
But no, you're absolutely right. An older generation divorce is almost, it's going to be extremely more complicated than, say, a couple of 20-year-olds who are married a couple of years who just have some paperwork and maybe a child that they need to figure out what to do.
Yeah, because, I mean, look how hard it is to just get along now. Now, you mentioned earlier, you said something about inheritance.
Yes.
And that got my, you know, brain thinking. How does that if you're married and then you're divorced, but then you collect the inheritance after the divorce, does that spouse are they entitled to that money?
Well, it's a great point, but it can be answered relatively simply, though. Wills are going to need to be redone. Obviously, upon the final judgment, all of that's going to have to change because obviously we won't talk specifically about probate-type issues. I know there's a probate attorney who comes in once in a while and answers questions about that type of stuff. But in a general way, wills are going to have to be redone. Obviously, the recipient spouse under a will is going to have to be changed, eliminated from the will as necessary. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, every circumstance is going to be different. There are going to be circumstances where from some measure you may even want to provide for an ex-spouse under the terms of will just because of the nature of the friendship or any number of reasons. But the bottom line is it is going to have to be changed because there's no longer a marital relationship. So certainly you don't want an ex-marital spouse taking under, say, the elective share or some other derivative.
Yeah, and watch that beneficiary too on that insurance policy.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly those insurance policies are going to have to be changed. Yeah. Health directives, insurance policies.
But say the ex comes into a windfall because a relative of theirs gives them a large chunk of money. Now, is that ex entitled to any of that?
It's going to depend on the circumstances of when that money's became due. There could be holdover issues that sort of survive the divorce. Every circumstance is going to be different. Am I going to just say abjectly no, it's out of the deal? That's not accurate.
Well, you are an attorney, right?
Yeah, and a contract in some circumstances is going to survive the marriage. For example, let's say in a mortgage situation, mortgage company doesn't care if parties got divorced. If both of those folks are on the note, mortgage on the note, you know, on the deed, all that stuff is going to have to be worked out because a mortgage banker is going to look to both parties, or at least the party with the deeper pockets, with respect to collecting on, say, a foreclosure. If there's a deficiency judgment at the end of a foreclosure, who's on that note and who can we go after? So those types of things all have to be addressed, and certainly the sooner the better. So in those cases, make sure that you've got a divorce attorney on your side who is going to be experienced, certainly capable of handling things practicably, ability to negotiate and get things settled if at all possible. Obviously, I always recommend these types of things. And as amicably as possible, you want to be represented by somebody who can get along with the other side, who can get along with the parties in the court. But obviously, if there are situations, particularly in high-dollar alimony cases or high-dollar marriages, where the parties simply want their day in court, and you have to be prepared as an attorney for that too.
Well, I would think that they would be the people who would fight the most. Because if you don't have nothing, you're not fighting over anything.
In some ways, Veronica, you are absolutely right. There are certain causes that just from a practical sense, because the parties cannot resolve it, either because one or both are being unreasonable, or maybe they're both willing to be reasonable in their own minds, but that's not reasonable to the other person, they're going to need a judge to make that determination. Mm-hmm. And I would say in a general way that's true. However, and we're getting off topic a little bit, I will also say pro bono cases can be just as difficult in situations where there are very few issues, very few assets. A lot of those cases end up going to trial because there's not things like attorney's fees hanging over the heads of the party or parties that are involved in it. So they just take their lawyer and go to court, have their day in court. It can be just as difficult for situations that are low-dollar cases.
Wow.
So in the end, like you said, it keeps us busy. Yeah. These types of issues definitely keep us busy. But with respect to these types of divorces, older generation, it's also important to take stock of where you're at financially. Who owns what is going to become a big issue. Get your name off of credit cards, other debt obligations if possible. Parties aren't going to want any more ties than are necessary with someone that is no longer going to be spending their life with you. Mm-hmm. Make copies of all financial statements you can find in the house. Get comfortable with what those numbers look like. Sometimes one spouse is going to be unaware of the real financial state of affairs, and this is a good time to quickly get up to speed, which is why it's going to be important in situations like that. If you find yourself as a spouse that's now involved in a divorce litigation, get an attorney who's going to be able to find out for you what is going on with the finances in that case. And then finally, a special concern for those that are facing a late-in-life divorce involving future payments. If one party is entitled to future payments as part of the alimony settlement, for instance, make sure that there's life and disability insurance in place to make sure that those spouses or soon-to-be ex-spouses that are responsible have the means to finish paying that obligation. So make sure that that is in place for purposes of protecting that alimony or spousal support award in the event of the other party's death or incapacity. So I was going to talk about the financial affidavit, but, you know, we just discussed parts of that last week. So I'm going to move to equitable distribution because both of these items are very closely tied to alimony. But equitable distribution is something new, and so I'm going to talk about a little bit about what that is in some detail. Now, Florida law provides for what's called equitable distribution of marital assets. And this means that all marital property and assets, as well as all marital debts that are acquired from the date of the party's marriage through the date of their separation, or sometimes the date of division or divorce, are going to be divided equitably, or in other words, fairly. Well, there's that word, fairly. And I know that Veronica and I have discussed that term. It's a buzzword for me because fairly is the most subjective term.
Yeah, fair to me might not be the same to you.
Well, it's not. Yeah. What you and I think are fair, we could spend every day in here together and you and I would never agree on what's fair. And don't even get me started on the freedom versus fairness argument for political purposes, because that is just a loser in my mind. Anyway, so fairness is going to be something that we're going to have to wrestle with as part of any divorce litigation, and certainly with equitable distribution. Judges are going to be tied, or the court's going to be tethered to deciding what is fair. It's a very subjective standard, so obviously that's something you're going to want to get resolved, if at all possible, before you go to court, because the judge is a disinterested third party. Ultimately, his or her job is to get these cases done as equitably as possible and move to the next case.
Do they kind of look at it as like equal is fair?
In some cases, absolutely. I mean, when we go to mediations, oftentimes you'll hear the mediator say, this is what they're going to do. They're going to cut the assets.
One for
and
you, one for me, one
that's
for
right.
you.
Okay. They're going to cut them right down the middle. Uh-huh. And for all intents and purposes, that's generally true. It doesn't show the whole picture, though. A judge is going to look at all the factors to just sort of figure out, all right, how can I do this as equitably and fairly as possible? That's why the term equitable and fair, I think they're synonymous, but not necessarily in all cases. It's not going to be 50-50 right down
right.
the middle,
mm-hmm.
even though for practical purposes we try to make people understand this is how it's going to look. And really, that opens people's eyes really the first time. They go to a mediation, the mediator says, look, this is all going to be divided. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly how it's going to be divided, but there's going to be a division here, and you guys are going to have to figure out what that means and how we're going to do that.
Sure, and then assets would have to be sold in order to divide.
In some cases.
Unless you could
absolutely.
Agree that you get this and I get that.
That's right.
I mean, this seems so complicated to me.
That's right. As I'm talking, I'm thinking about the complexity of it, and you're right. It becomes very complex, and it's something that ultimately the parties have to work through, which is why they hire representatives to help
them. I mean, basically, you're dividing your life.
Yeah, and who wants to do that?
Yeah.
You know, who wants to do that? I mean, a lot of times what happens is you end up having to sort of prod people to move forward. I've been in many mediations where we've gotten everything resolved, everything's been done, and one party will stand up and go, you know what, I don't know if I can do this. I may need a day or two to think about it. And the next thing you know, you've got to sort of rein them in and say, well, everything's worked out here. What's the issue? And in most of those cases, it's simply subjective. Their life is being changed.
Right.
Everything's being divided up in a mathematical sort of fashion where it's like, when I was married, I wasn't thinking in terms of just being pluses and minuses, and that's what it becomes. So the divorce court will consider assets and debts marital, even if they were acquired by only one spouse. During the marriage, were titled only in one spouse's name, as long as those items are not exempted from the marital estate due to things like a prenuptial agreement, inheritance, gift from third party, or otherwise. Increases in value of non-marital assets may, in some circumstances, also be considered a marital asset. We've got to look at the three steps that are necessary to resolving Florida's equitable distribution matters. This is part of the interesting aspect of this that I wanted to get into a little bit with the time that we've got left. The first step for a Florida property distribution attorney or a marital attorney in analyzing the Florida equitable distribution of marital property is to identify or locate the assets of the debts of the parties. Identifying them, locating them, it's generally going to be accomplished through a legal process known as discovery. Fairly simple concept. It's a process whereby an experienced attorney is going to submit written questions to the other side regarding marital property and debts. A written response is going to be required. Typically, there's about 45 days, but that's sort of a sliding scale depending on the agreement and the ability of the parties, the attorneys, to get along and sort of move this stuff forward without all of the formalities of having to run to court. But other times, the Florida Equitable Distribution Attorney may request documents to be produced by the other spouse or may conduct a deposition and require the deposed spouse to answer questions under oath. This is all part of the discovery process, and in some circumstances, that exchange of documents and information is just going to be required under Florida law. I mean, think of it this way. It's going to have to be done. As part of every divorce that I endeavor upon, I send out what are called interrogatories and requests to produce document production requests with all of the pleadings. And I think most attorneys actually do that. I sometimes get them where the entire packet that I typically will send out is not complete. And I've actually had dialogues, both phone calls from attorneys and phone calls that I've made where a document or two was overlooked as part of the initial pleading. And from a technical standpoint, we could file for motions to dismiss. Very rarely does that happen, though, and that oftentimes simply has to do with it can be as simple as the relationship of the attorneys one to the other. I mean, even though you know you're paid to go in and fight and argue, those are important aspects of what we do for litigation purposes. Being able to get along with the other side is really important too, because let's face it, it's paperwork. Sometimes documents are, if not overlooked, perhaps they get lost. They get lost in the mail. Whatever. The important thing is those things ultimately get addressed. The parties share the documentation in the time that is typically necessary to do that, and you move on to the next stage of the litigation. There are circumstances, however, where information may never be uncovered unless it's requested and obtained by subpoena or some other means. The discovery process is critically important. The bottom line is it's very important when it's believed that a spouse may have hidden assets during the marriage in an attempt to prevent the other spouse from obtaining a fair property distribution settlement. Let's say, for example, somebody owns a cash business. And like we said at the outset of this, there might be circumstances where one spouse doesn't really know the financial aspects of the marriage because they, for whatever reason, never paid the bills or they just don't know. They've just been happy.
That's so old-fashioned, and we're so modern these days. I find that so bizarre that, you know, find out. You
yeah.
should know.
Find
I
out.
Think that you should, everyone should know.
Information is so readily available,
you know,
on all sorts
oh,
of
Oh, I don't
fronts.
Worry about that. The bills are just paid.
Yep. Nonetheless, there will be circumstances where one spouse can show, look, I simply didn't know what was going on. There may be circumstances where businesses are run on a cash basis, in which case there will be circumstances where you know as an attorney that the assets are there and you simply can't prove it. And that's when you get into forensic accounting and other aspects that we've talked about on previous shows for purposes of ultimately finding out what do the assets really reflect. So once you identify the assets, the next thing to do is to characterize the asset. What kind of an asset are we talking about? And listen, I know that that sounds a little bit tedious, but the difference between marital and non-marital assets is often very critical. The identifying the character of the asset in the equitable distribution is step two. Assets acquired before the date of marriage, assets acquired through inheritance or gift, excluded by way of a prenuptial agreement or you know, all those things. Those are generally characterized as non-marital property. An exception to that is, for example, the increase in value during the marriage of a non-marital asset. That's generally going to be considered as marital. For example, you inherit $100,000 from a family member. Over the course of a 20-year marriage, that $100,000 turns into $200,000. Well, that portion, the equitable increase is now going to become a part of a marital asset for those purposes. Now, generally, all other assets acquired during the spouse's marriage are considered marital property. And those are all going to be subject to the equitable distribution process.
What if you were to inherit your father's business? Is it the money that the business earns would be divided, or would part of that business be given to the ex?
I think if we're talking in a general way, we're going to say that the gain of that business's value will certainly be a marital asset,
okay.
Assuming that the parties are going to keep or
but
the
not
parties
the business itself.
The business itself that is inherited, the value of that, just in general, based upon your example, I would say that that is going to be deemed non-marital because of the nature of the inheritance. However, obviously, the question will be arising regarding the proceeds from the business. Mm-hmm. If it's earning income, mm-hmm. certainly we're looking at marital asset there,
okay.
As well as the value of that business, like we said. Also, a loss in value may then become a marital liability, depending upon the nature of how that loss of value manifests. Mm-hmm. We may be looking at the possibility of, okay, well, they ran the business together after it was inherited by one of them. What does that mean? Those are the types of mm-hmm. things. And those become very complicated issues as you're raising. I mean, there's going to be attorneys and possibly accountants and forensic accountants who are looking at those types of things.
Does how it transfers from the father to the son or daughter, you know, how it transfers, would that play a part in a future divorce? I mean, if they're getting along fine and the business transfers from a father to a son and then they split later?
Are you talking about
how
an
it's titled or how it's transferred from one to the other?
Yeah, I guess that's a possible. That's certainly going to be an issue that we're going to look at. If it's inheritance versus, say, giving the business to a person or perhaps selling it to them, mm-hmm. those are going to be tax issues as well as the possibility of marital versus non-marital.
So you would need probably an attorney at the time of transfer would be a good idea.
Yeah, and I think just as the practical answer here is one side may look at that differently than it actually is in terms of what the law says. But, you know, sometimes issues can be raised simply for the purpose of leverage. And so that's one of the jobs that an attorney sometimes has to do. Well, we've got this nebulous business that was given or inherited by the other side. Is it, depending on how we argue it, we may be able to look at it as marital or non-marital. And those types of issues then become, all right, we got to litigate it. Let's at least try to figure it out, negotiate whatever. When I say litigation, I'm generally including the negotiative type elements of what goes into finally getting these cases resolved as well. You raise the issue is mm-hmm. the short answer, and it becomes an issue in the case. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it's legally, fundamentally, one way or the other, that becomes the question. All right? Just to sum up the characterization, the same rules are going to hold true regarding debts, marital or non-marital. It sounds easy to characterize assets and debts as marital or non-marital. Actually, I think Veronica and I have done a pretty good job of illustrating how it's not always easy to make that determination.
Well, I definitely want to share the debt.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
I want to split that right down the middle.
You're going to want to split that down the middle.
I'm not even going to argue about that.
except if there's a way that you might be able to get out of it altogether.
Oh, well, then that would be a good thing. Can you do that for me?
I might be able to do that for you. There might be an attorney who's able to do that for you. And so, and I guess the greater point is that that's not always the case, especially when non-marital and marital assets are commingled. And I think in a sort of general sense, that's what we're talking about today. Once you get into the commingling of assets and liabilities, everything sort of goes from being black and white to gray, and then it becomes a matter of parsing those things out. And, you know, this is the type of stuff that keeps an attorney up at night. You know, the spouses, obviously, you can imagine how difficult it must be for them. But the attorneys, too, they're under the pressure to perform. They've got to do the best for their client. And a lot of times these questions are really hard to answer, and it's going to ultimately fall upon a judge to make that call.
I think if you're contemplating divorce, you've probably already divided everything in your head. You kind of already know what you want.
Oh, yeah. You've divided something in your head. I've divided something in my head, and now we have to figure out if those two things
match.
Are the same, because if they're not, then we've got
to
work that out.
And then
you've
got to go to the judge, and then he's looking at it again.
Yep.
Yeah.
And at the center of the storm, there's a couple of dogs. And who gets the dogs?
Oh, goodness. That's probably worse than dividing the children.
That's right. Real quickly, the third step in this analysis is going to be the valuation of the assets. Determine what the value in the assets of debts are going to be. And sometimes one of those can offset the other. Sometimes the assets can offset the debts. Sometimes the value of the debts can offset the assets. The balances in bank accounts or the amounts owed on credit cards, those are usually readily apparent. Other assets and debts may require that experts be retained. And we've been talking a lot about this type of stuff. You figure out what those values are for a fair determination of the overall value of the marital estate. In divorce cases where real estate valuation issues emerge, a law firm may hire real estate appraisers. You may have accountants and real estate appraisers involved in certain cases, and in many cases that's actually what happens. In a case where a cash value of a pension plan is involved, you're going to have an actuary who's going to perform present-day cash value determinations. Something called a QDRO, or a Qualified Domestic Relations Order, is going to be used. An outside third party is going to determine the valuation of a retirement, and that number is going to be reduced to present-day dollar value, so that at the time of retirement, those monies can be divided. And from a typical standpoint, retirement can be split 50-50 based upon present-day valuations, and then that money will be divided at the time of of the person's retirement. Say you're working for a business that has a mandatory retirement, like the airlines. There will be a dollar figure that's ultimately ascertained and associated with that person's retirement through the QDRO or the Qualified Domestic Relations Order, and that number will be what the recipient spouse will receive at the end of that person's retirement. In the cases where a spouse owns a business, business valuation experts or other forensic accountants may be retained, of course, and we've been down that road. But examples of marital assets in a Florida divorce include the following: marital home, retirement plans, business interests, including interests in corporations and partnerships. So obviously, financial affidavit, you're going to be very careful to note the information on that affidavit regarding the other side's interests, especially to the extent that you know them, and any partnerships that are involved, the whole corporate, all the corporate entities that a party might be involved with. Motor vehicles, including cars, airplanes, boats, RVs, and other vehicles. I know the intent is to, the feeling is to laugh when you start hearing about situations like that, but believe it or not, people get divorced who have lots of money. Things like planes and radio stations and boats and RVs all of a sudden become in play as part of dividing that marital estate. Stocks and bonds, obviously. Cash and money that is owed from one spouse to another, perhaps per some agreement, be it verbal or otherwise. Furnishings, furniture, collectibles, jewelry, sporting and entertainment equipment. There may be an emotional investment in a particular piece of jewelry that one or both sides are interested in. They have to figure out how to divide that up or sell it. Cash value of life insurance policies. Obviously, examples of marital debts would be mortgages, credit card accounts, automobile or other vehicle loans, which becomes in itself its own sort of cottage industry, because you've got the value of a car, you've got the debt that's on the car, and often those things are upside down. And of course, you've got who is on the title of the vehicle. Is it one or both parties? Sometimes a spouse is paying for a title that is a car that's titled to the other person. Sometimes that other person is the only person on the debt, but the payer spouse is the